When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You've probably heard of pay to play, but what about play to not get paid? That has been the reality for countless college athletes. Over the century, the NCAA has acted as a governing board for collegiate sports. What else has been the reality? The different treatment of men and women in college athletics. Both came to a boiling point in the public eye over the last decade, with the lawsuit against EA Sports and the apparent sexism exhibited by the NCAA in the 2021 March Madness tournament. So, what's going on here, and how has the NCAA changed over the years? Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Corporate Casket. I'm the Illuminati, and today we're going to be talking about the NCAA.
I was paid to bring girls to entertain recruits and players, as well as have sex with...
Tell me how you're going to get all your work done when you get out at 7:30 or so. You got a test the next day, you're dead tired from practice, and you still have to study just as hard as everybody else every day.
When it comes down to it, I think about it like you do a movie. Not many of those guys are stars in the movie, but they're all extras. You can't have a movie without extras, so they deserve to be paid by the people that are putting the entertainment product out.
Should players be paid or not? How does that impact sports? Are women's sports treated differently? And if so, why? All of those things can be highly contentious, but today we're just going to talk about the different lawsuits and instances that have been the most impactful for the governing body of the NCAA and the athletes that they regulate. So let's get started with some background. What is the NCAA and where did it come from? In the early 1900s, before the NCAA existed and were in control of the world of college sports, athletics and especially football were completely different than they are now. Prior to 1910, college football teams were largely filled with paid players. These players were rarely enrolled in the school and were hired to play and fill the roster. Additionally, football was vastly more dangerous than it is now. During just one season in 1904, there were 18 deaths in college football and 159 serious injuries on the field. And that's insane. College football was outrageously popular, though, as I mentioned in my first episode on the NFL, but obviously, it's kind of hard to ignore the sheer brutality of the sport and the unacceptable amount of deaths and injuries. This caused many people in the public to push for the sport to be reformed. The issue got so pervasive that the president at the time, Theodore Roosevelt, called the leaders of Harvard, Princeton, and Yale's athletic departments to urge them to clean up the game and to prevent it from being abolished altogether. In the wake of yet another season plagued by injuries and deaths in 1905, 62 colleges and universities came together to form the Intercollegiate Athletic Association of the United States, which would soon become the NCAA. Only 1 year later, the NCAA became a rulemaking body for collegiate sports. However, in the first few years of its inception, the NCAA did not play a major role in controlling college athletics other than creating rules for football or other sports and developing college national championships. The first of which, the National Collegiate Track and Field Championships, was held in 1921. But as college athletics began to expand as a pivotal aspect of the American higher education system, the power of the NCAA began to dramatically grow. The increasing commercialization of college athletics was a rising concern for many in the public, and in 1929, the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Education issued the following warning that commercialism in college athletics must be diminished, and college sport must rise to a point where it is esteemed primarily and sincerely for the opportunities it affords to mature youth. In other words, people were looking for collegiate athletics to be less about making money and selling the sports and more about the integrity of sports and education. In an attempt to ensure that college athletics became less commercialized and more amateur, the NCAA adopted the Sanity Code after World War II that placed regulations on the financial aid, recruitment, and academic standards of college athletes. Then, in 1951, the NCAA strengthened these codes by developing the Committee of Infractions, which had a wide range of sanctioning authority that could still be utilized against schools that skirted regulations. But despite all of the announcements and statements by the NCAA that their purpose was to decommercialize college sports, as their power grew, they quickly became the ones that seemed to be commercializing them more. In the 1950s, the NCAA negotiated their first television contract that resulted in more than $1 million. And from there, the television contracts only grew, and so did their power. Over the years, the NCAA would develop divisions for athletics as more schools began investing large sums into their athletics department as an attempt to provide a more equal playing field between the large programs and the smaller ones that were unable to keep up with them. Then, when Title IX passed in the 1970s requiring equality and prohibiting sex discrimination in education, the NCAA began to establish women's national championships.
As will Margaret Grant, Tana Vanderway, and Dana Smith. For UCLA, Jeannie Beaupre will be the setter and floor general with Linda Robertson.
As time has continued on, the NCAA has become a massive legislative entity in the world of college sports, controlling national championships, scheduling, enforcing regulations, distributing punishments, and making millions of dollars on television contracts. But their push to keep college athletics amateur has often been questioned and critiqued as being exploitative, as has their longstanding history of treating men and women's sports differently. In the late 1990s, the NCAA found itself in a massive civil suit claiming that the organization had violated the Title IX law that forbids discrimination based on sex. Title IX states, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied of the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial aid." Now, pay special attention to that last portion of the statement, because that is vital in cases with the NCAA and Title IX. But anyway, the lawsuit came after Renee M. Smith, who had played volleyball during her undergraduate for St. Bonaventure University, requested permission from the NCAA to continue playing volleyball with a different institution as a graduate student. When her request was denied, Smith filed a lawsuit for a Title IX violation, claiming that the NCAA accepted requests for men to play as graduates far more than they did women. After a variety of decisions in lower courts, the case NCAA v. Smith finally went to the Supreme Court in 1999. The key question was this: was the NCAA an educational program that received federal financial aid? And if so, did they violate Title IX? You see, the question was kind of tricky because while the NCAA is technically a nonprofit institution that does not receive federal funding, they do receive dues from colleges and universities, and they, on the other hand, do receive federal funding. In the end, the Supreme Court sided with the NCAA and even went as far as to say that they did not have to adhere to Title IX. In the Supreme Court's decision written by the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she wrote, "The association's receipt of dues demonstrates that it indirectly benefits from the federal assistance afforded its members, which is insufficient to trigger the Title IX coverage." So basically, because the NCAA indirectly receives federal funding, the court determined that they are not legally obligated to follow Title IX. Now, this can be a little bit of a red flag, considering the protections the law offers women in college sports. However, the NCAA did say that they should be in compliance with Title IX on a voluntary basis and have worked to achieve compliance. Although the NCAA does claim that though they are not legally obligated to adhere to Title IX, there have been some questions about their commitment to gender equality in sports. Even before this lawsuit in 1993, the NCAA found that 70% of participation opportunities and scholarship funds went to male athletes, along with 77% of operating budgets and 83% of recruiting budgets. And this was about 20 years after women's sports were brought under the wing of the NCAA. However, schools have made at least some strides in this department and reported in 2017 that they have severely narrowed the expense gap between men and women collegiate sports to 42% for men and 36% for women. Regardless, it's still important to note that it's not equal. While yes, football obviously plays a factor in being the biggest sport in most schools and obviously predominantly male, but still. The NCAA faced probably their biggest bombshell scandal regarding discrimination in 2021 when the different treatment of men and women during the March Madness tournament practically broke the internet.
The NCAA is apologizing after being criticized for the stark difference in the fitness facilities provided to the men and the women competing in the college basketball tournaments. Oregon's Sedona Prince gave us a glimpse of the weight room differences in a social media video last Thursday.
So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room.
As you can see, the men were provided with a lot more equipment than...
March Madness has become one of the biggest phenomena in college sports, from the tournament itself to the brackets filled out by thousands of fans each year. However, when the hardworking and talented men and women showed up for the 2021 March Madness events, men were met with high-class weight rooms, swanky gift bags, and buffet meals. Meanwhile, the women were met with a very dissimilar setup. The women's so-called weight room included one stack of dumbbells and just a handful of yoga mats, which were meant for the 64 teams to share. Now, just a reminder, this was the room where the most elite women college basketball players were meant to prepare for the biggest tournament of their lives, and that's what they got. Meanwhile, on the men's side of the NCAA tournament, they had a full-fledged gym. Their gym included multiple racks of dumbbells, of which heavier weights than offered to the women were there, benches, and lifting racks. Like, imagine what you would see at most gym kind of membership setups. Like, that was what they had. Shortly after arriving, the women quickly spread the news of the stark differences between the two sides of the bubble in San Antonio through social media. At first, the NCAA tried to make an excuse for the difference in weight rooms by saying there was limited space to provide the women with a full gym. The official statement released by Lynn Holtzman, NCAA Vice President of Women's Basketball, reads in part, "We acknowledge that some of the amenities teams would typically have access to have not been available inside the controlled environment. In part, this is due to the limited space, and the original plan was to expand the workout area once additional space was available later in the tournament." But unfortunately for the NCAA, this was quickly discovered to be, as Insider puts it, a blatant lie. Shortly after they released the statement with limited spaces as an excuse, Sedona Prince, a player for the Oregon Ducks, took to social media to disprove it. In a video posted on Twitter, she showed the women's gym, which honestly was pretty much what you might find in someone's home gym or even less, and then quickly showed the supposed lack of space. But the problem was there wasn't a lack of space at all, and in fact there was a giant conference room with nothing other than plenty of empty rooms and some folding chairs, similar to the amount of space the men had in their gym, just, you know, minus all the equipment. At the end of the video, after pointing out the truth behind the NCAA's space issues, Sedona Prince says, "If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it." Following the immediate outrage over the gyms, other differing aspects between the men and women's tournaments were quickly pointed out. For one, the meals provided for the men's and women's teams were drastically different. While the men received buffets with a plethora of options, the women received prepackaged meals, which honestly, when you look at them, it looked like they were just kind of frozen dinners that someone had left over in their fridge. Additionally, pictures of the swag bags given to both the men's and women's teams showed that the men's bags seemed drastically more substantial and they received more merchandise than the women athletes. Perhaps the most shocking and disheartening difference was between the COVID-19 testing utilized for men and women. While the men received daily PCR tests, the women instead received daily antigen testing. PCR tests were considered to be far more accurate, and in fact, when one woman tested positive, she was then given a PCR test to confirm that the original positive provided by the antigen test was actually false. Following the discovery of the plethora of inequalities between the treatment of players in the March Madness tournament, many people spoke out in opposition to the NCAA's actions. Tan Van Der Deer, the coach for Stanford, said in a statement that she was upset by the evidence of blatant sexism by the NCAA and called it purposeful and hurtful. Other people, including multiple former, current, or soon-to-be professional athletes like Sue Bird, Natasha Cloud, CJ McCollum, and Steph Curry, spoke out on Twitter. Some called the actions of the NCAA disrespectful, and others demanded answers from the NCAA on their apparent, and honestly I would use the word blatant here, sexism. The NCAA held a Zoom call with players and coaches shortly after the news of unequal treatment basically broke the whole internet and finally acknowledged the issues and apologized. The NCAA Senior Vice President of Basketball, Dan Gravitt, said during the meeting, "I apologize to the women, student athletes, coaches, and committee for dropping the ball on the weight room issue in San Antonio. We'll get it fixed as soon as possible." But even though there was a visible difference in the swag bag for the men and women playing in the tournament, the NCAA, when asked by the players and Associated Press about the discrepancy, responded by saying that the value of the bags was equitable. Despite the apology and the acknowledgement from the NCAA, the fact remains that they were met with a difficult situation in planning the tournament in a bubble atmosphere. The women were the only ones that met the brunt of the planning difficulties, while the men were spared. As the coach of South Carolina, Don Staley, pointed out, all teams dealt with the same struggles during COVID-19, but the men's reward was much different. While this was certainly a controversial situation with the NCAA, this is far from the public's biggest concern with the governing body of collegiate sports. The payment of players, or more accurately, the lack of, has been an ongoing conversation in regards to how the NCAA governs collegiate sports, and it all came to a head with EA Sports NCAA games. In 2003, EA Sports released their NCAA football and basketball video games. It was a little different than Madden and other sports games in that it did not use any of the players' real names. Instead, to avoid using the exact likeness of the players who were still currently in college, they used numbers, the skill sets, and the general appearances of the athletes represented. Why did they do this? Well, according to the NCAA regulations at the time, athletes in collegiate sports were unable to profit from their name, image, and likeness while in school. So, EA decided to just use general numbers of the players to avoid having to compensate them for their presence in the game. Now, I just want to make it very clear that even though players' names weren't used for the game, their likeness was remarkably similar. And I mean, same measurements as the actual person, same type of skills, same skin color. And despite the fact that players featured in the game weren't being paid, it was remarkably successful. That is until 2009. In the summer of 2009, a former UCLA basketball player, Ed O'Bannon, sued the NCAA, Electronic Arts, and the Collegiate Licensing Company. The lawsuit claimed that while the NCAA, its member conference and schools, and its for-profit business partnerships reap millions of dollars from revenue streams, former student athletes whose likenesses are utilized to generate those profit centers receive no compensation whatsoever. The lawsuit not only brought up the incredible similarities between the players in the game and real-life athletes, it also pointed out that there was clear evidence that EA was using the real players' likenesses to develop the players in the game. Anyone playing the game could easily download a spreadsheet online that revealed the players' names and other stats like their real-life jersey numbers, hometown, and year of eligibility. In other words, it was incredibly easy to tell which player was which, and they didn't do a phenomenal job of hiding the likeness. At first, the NCAA adamantly denied the claim that they'd done anything wrong by essentially selling the player's likeness to be turned into a profit and fought to have the case dismissed. However, a U.S. district judge in San Francisco denied their motion to dismiss the lawsuit, and it continued on. As the lawsuit continued forward, more players joined, including former basketball and football players. In May 2011, EA probably thought they could breathe a sigh of relief when a federal judge dismissed them for the lawsuit. Though the judge said the evidence against the NCAA and Collegiate Licensing Company was strong enough to continue the suit, they decided that there was a lack of evidence that EA had worked with the NCAA in refusing to pay players used in the game. But that sigh of relief did not last for long for the massive entertainment company, and they were put back into the lawsuit just a few months later after the plaintiffs showed proof that EA did, indeed, work with the NCAA to deny payments to athletes even after their college careers had ended. Then, new emails emerged that showed that the NCAA had known that EA was making the game to match the exact descriptions of college players. The emails sent in 2003 showed NCAA Director of Corporate Alliances Peter Davis responding to an EA executive telling him that they don't actually use player names, but we do use all the attributes and jersey numbers of the players. So, while the NCAA was desperately trying to claim during the lawsuit that they were not aware that players' likeness was being used in the games, this email exchange clearly showed it was. The email exchange even revealed that if players got hurt in real life, the game would actually reflect that. Separate emails from 2007 showed the NCAA Vice President Greg Shaheen pushing for the NCAA to develop legislation that allowed EA to use the names and the likeness of current college athletes. He speculated that the current athletes would prefer their names to be used and said, "The issue for me is that the names and likenesses are rigged into the games now by illegal means, meaning that many of the video game players have the features. It's just that our membership doesn't benefit from it." 4 years after the original lawsuit was filed, EA and CLC announced that they had settled their claims with the plaintiffs. The settlement came with a $40 million price tag. However, EA did not admit to any wrongdoing. They also decided they would no longer be making the NCAA video games and announced that they would not make the 2014 version. But they also claimed that this was not their decision. The company alleged in court documents that they had wished to continue making the game and were even willing to pay players moving forward, but the NCAA's resistance to allowing players to make a profit while in school stopped them. While this marked the end of the lawsuit for CLC and EA, the NCAA continued on. Shortly after, the announcement was made that two co-defendants had settled, the NCAA announced that they would be continuing on and even expanding on their legal team to fight the case. Donald Remy, the chief legal officer with the NCAA, told USA Today, "We're prepared to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if we have to. We are not prepared to compromise on the case." I'm sure the NCAA was hoping this type of statement would scare off their opponents, or were hoping that they would just take the settlements and give up on the NCAA aspect of the lawsuit. But that's certainly not what happened. Instead, the lawyers for the plaintiff's side seemed virtually elated to hear the NCAA wanted to continue on with the suit. One said, quote, "Fantastic, we'll see them in court." While another said, "The NCAA now stands alone in its hypocrisy. When you hire a new firm to deal with a trial and a firm to deal with an appeal, it doesn't say a lot about your confidence in your position." It turns out that appeal team would come in handy for the NCAA as the case went on for another 2 years. In 2014, the O'Bannon v. NCAA case began a tumultuous three-week trial. In it, multiple athletes testified regarding their experiences as college athletes and addressed the issues of amateurism in the NCAA and the question of whether or not they violated federal antitrust laws. O'Bannon himself testified in the trial and alluded to his experience of being a college athlete as a full-time job, which often prevented him from being a good student while not being paid. O'Bannon said, "I was an athlete masquerading as a student. I was there strictly to play basketball. I basically did the minimum to make sure I kept eligibility academically so I could continue to play." Other athletes echoed his statements and testified that playing their respective sports was treated as their occupation and said that playing the sport made it near impossible to act and behave like other students. But the NCAA also brought their own witnesses who argued that allowing athletes to profit during their collegiate careers would destroy the sanctity of sports and in turn cause college athletes to lose fans and supporters. They also made the argument, which has been made continuously for years, that the payment for players is their education. Athletes, on the other hand, argue that limiting their payment to only tuition has been unfair. By the end of the three-week trial, the federal judge, U.S. District Judge Claudia Wilkin, released a 99-page decision that ultimately sided with O'Bannon and the other 19 people that joined the suit. Wilkin wrote that the challenged NCAA rules unreasonably restrain trade in the market for certain educational and athletic opportunities offered by NCAA Division I schools. Wilkin also stated that the NCAA could not prohibit an athlete from getting deferred compensation of $5,000 or less. There was no reasoning as to why it would be $5,000 and not like $1,000 or $10,000, but it just seems like it was just an arbitrary number. But the way this would have supposedly worked out is that an athlete's compensation would have been placed in a trust fund while they were playing and in school, and then when they left, they'd be able to access the funds. However, if a school never sold the players' names, likeness, or image, or any of that, they would not receive this compensation and only receive their scholarship. Bill Isaacson, one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs, said after the decision was released, "This is a major step towards decency for college athletes. The judge's decision strikes down NCAA rules restricting their compensation and permits reasonable but significant sharing with athletes, both for the cost of education and to establish trust funds, from the billions in revenues that schools earn from their football and basketball players." While this was certainly exciting news for the players, it was unfortunately short-lived. In September 2015, an appeals court agreed that the NCAA was not above antitrust laws and had rules that were unnecessary to maintain amateurism. However, they shot down the ruling that the NCAA should allow colleges to pay $5,000 to be placed in a trust fund. The NCAA seemed pleased with this ruling, and the president, Mark Emmer, told reporters, "I was particularly pleased that the court recognized the fundamental difference between providing support for student athletes that's education-related and, to use their words, cash sums that were untethered to educational expenses." The O'Bannon plaintiffs sought for the Supreme Court to hear the case, but in 2016 they were ultimately denied and the second ruling stood. While it seems like this may have been a loss for the players, that wasn't 100% true. Yes, they lost their right to get the $5,000 trust fund stipend, but they also got multiple federal judges to agree that the NCAA was in violation of antitrust laws, which opened the doors for other lawsuits in the future to make a bigger impact on the future of collegiate sports. In fact, that's exactly what happened, and other lawsuits emerged that changed the rules and regulations of the NCAA. And before we continue on to explore some of those changes and new regulations, let's take a quick moment to thank today's sponsors. At the end of what can feel like an endless workday, the last thing I want to do is cook some dinner. But when the fridge is empty, that urge to order in and skip cooking happens all too often. But thanks to Daily Harvest, I don't have to take that takeout temptation much longer. Daily Harvest helps me keep my freezer fully stocked with options that are delivered right to my door that are delicious, nourishing, and ready in minutes. Daily Harvest delivers delicious harvest bowls, soups, flatbreads, snacks, smoothies, lattes, and more built on all organic fruits and vegetables. And they have delicious options for every time of the day: breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, and dessert. I think you guys know I've long been on a smoothie kick from Daily Harvest for way over a year. It's got to be pushing 2 years at this point of this addiction to smoothies. And right now I've been rehooked on the pineapple matcha smoothie. It is to die for. And with Daily Harvest, I never have to question if the food is good for me because they create food that's good for my health and the health of the planet. So avoid the takeout temptation and get Daily Harvest. Go to dailyharvest.com/MLM and get up to $40 off your first box. That's dailyharvest.com/MLM for up to $40 off your first box. dailyharvest.com/MLM. Today's episode is sponsored by America's number one meal kit, HelloFresh. HelloFresh sends farm-fresh seasonal recipes with pre-portioned ingredients straight to you. It lets you cut out mealtime planning and searching around the grocery store and even cuts down time in the kitchen, with most meals taking 30 minutes or less. So you get convenience, you get quality, and you get deliciousness. Plus, there's so much variety and ability to customize your order to your needs. I don't know how many times I can emphasize that I love planning things. And when I get to plan my meals like 6 weeks in advance with HelloFresh and know exactly what's coming, when it's coming, and all of that, it's the easiest. It is the best thing in the world. And you can do it all on their app. So it doesn't matter if I want to swap out a protein to change what's on the menu exactly or upgrade to create a more luxe version of my meal. There's something for everybody. So if you want to get started, make sure you go to HelloFresh.com/MLM16 and use code MLM16 for up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts. That's up to 16 free meals and 3 free gifts at HelloFresh.com/MLM16 with code MLM16.
The NCAA has sent a letter to the governor of California asking him not to sign a bill that would give college athletes a chance to accept endorsement money while they're in school. In the letter, the NCAA calls the Fair Pay to Play Act harmful and unconstitutional, adding that it would, quote, upend the balance of national competition in college sports. Let me put that in English. The California legislature passed a bill that will allow, and unanimously, that would allow college athletes to benefit from their likeness, endorsements, and things like that, not to be paid by their universities. The governor has to sign it. The NCAA is essentially saying to the governor, don't sign it, because if you do, it's going to keep the California schools from being able to compete in our championships. That's essentially what we're saying. Dominique, quick thought.
I mean, it doesn't make a difference, honestly. I hate to be the one.
The game officially began to change in 2019 when California passed the Fair to Play Act, allowing college athletes to profit from the commercial use of their identities. The act not only made it so college athletes could benefit from the use of their names, image, and likeness, but also allowed college athletes to hire agents to negotiate their contracts, which had previously been banned. The act still did not allow athletes to be paid by their individual academic institutes. It only allowed them to be paid by outside entities. Still, this was definitely a win. In the months that followed, multiple other states like Nevada, New York, and Pennsylvania either passed a similar bill or said they would be open to doing so. Athletes saw yet another victory in 2020 when the Supreme Court announced that they would hear a case regarding education-related compensation for college athletes. The Alston v. NCAA case began shortly after the O'Bannon decision and sought to address yet again the lack of compensation for college athletes. The announcement that the Supreme Court would hear the case came after the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled that the NCAA could not place caps on education-related compensation for student athletes. This meant that players could be compensated through internships, among other things, while in school, which had previously been against NCAA regulations. In June 2021, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the NCAA could not limit education benefits to college athletes. This opened the door for college athletes to participate in student internships, study abroad programs, and could receive things like laptops for the very first time. Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote in the decision that allowing colleges to offer college athletes enhanced education-related benefits may encourage scholastic achievement and allow student athletes a measure of compensation more consistent with the value they bring to their schools. Justice Brett Kavanaugh also wrote, "Nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate." This is a fair point, and one that's been brought up multiple times during the conversation of paying athletes or not. No other business would be allowed to do this, so why the NCAA? This ruling came at the same time that the Fair to Play laws had been appearing across the country, and the NCAA was wrestling with their decision of whether or not to allow college athletes to benefit from their name, image, and likeness. In fact, the NCAA was busy facing yet another lawsuit on that issue, even before this decision. In 2020, Sedona Price, who you may remember as the person who outed the NCAA's outright lie about there not being space for gym equipment during the March Madness, along with two other Pac-12 players, sued the NCAA for television revenue and social media earnings. Again, the lawsuit claims that the NCAA violated federal antitrust laws. This lawsuit focused heavily on the fact that many college athletes could have been making money from their social media presence, but were barred from this possibility by the NCAA regulations. Sedona filed the lawsuit after she had spent a year injured in Texas and transferred to Oregon. However, her waiver application to play with Oregon the year she transferred was denied because she was unable to be compensated at all during her injury. Sedona said she had undergone multiple surgeries and was struggling with medical bills that were amounting to tens of thousands of dollars. Despite this, she was unable to receive any outside compensation from endorsements or social media because of the NCAA. Sedona went on to say, "For all the hard work college athletes put in, for all the risks we take and injuries we sustain, and for all the money we generate, we should at least be able to share in profits that can be made off of our own names, images, and likenesses." While there haven't been any monumental updates on the case, it may be a moot point, as the NCAA finally decided to amend their rules shortly after the Alston ruling. In late July 2021, the NCAA announced that they were suspending their rules on name, image, and likeness. The new rules allowed players, regardless of the school they attended or which state they were in, to benefit from their name, image, and likeness opportunities. The NCAA made it clear in their announcement that this would be a temporary policy and remain in place until new federal legislation regarding paying college athletes came to light or new NCAA regulations emerged. The news was met with a mixed bag of reviews. Obviously, many former and current athletes rejoiced, excited that they would finally be able to make a profit while playing in college. Some schools, like Georgia Tech, helped to organize massive endorsement deals for their players. Georgia Tech helped to negotiate a deal between TiVo and their players where they received a profit for agreeing to promote the company on their social media accounts. Some players signed endorsement deals mere minutes after the new rules went into effect. Meanwhile, others questioned how the new rules would impact college sports. Some worried that the new rules would just cause jealousy among teammates since the amount of money players are making, if any, would and did vary heavily. Players were also worried that this would severely impact the transfer portal in schools, with players wanting the schools to give them a bigger name and inherently earn more money. And others argued that the sports would apparently be less enjoyable to watch now that players were being paid, which I don't understand that one, but okay. The new rules also prompted EA Sports to announce that they would be bringing back the popular and controversial video game that, in all honesty, started a lot of this progress and subsequent rule changes. There doesn't seem to be an exact date on when the game will be back, but it's scheduled to be coming back sometime in 2023, so apparently, if you're interested, keep your eyes out for it. In February 2022, the NCAA announced that they would be reviewing their NIL policies to analyze how and if the change of name, image, and likeness rules had an impact on various things among college athletes, such as their school choice, academics, and mental health. The Division I Board of Directors also met to discuss the past year with NIL policies, and Board Chair and the University of Georgia President, Jer Moorhead, said, "We want to preserve the positive aspects of the new policy while reviewing whether anything can be done to mitigate the negative ones. The review is expected to be completed by June or July of this year, so we'll have to keep an eye on that and see what happens." But with all of that being said, that's where we're going to end today's episode of The Corporate Casket. So what do you think? Should college players be able to profit while in school? What about the whole March Madness debacle? Does the NCAA treat women's sports differently than men's? Let us know. And if you enjoyed this episode, I highly recommend checking out the other episodes on the NFL and the WWE. But again, this is the end of today's episode. Thank you so much for spending some of your time here with me. I really do appreciate it. And as always, I'll see you in the next one. Bye.